Job 15. As we ended 2 weeks ago, last week was singing night, but as we ended 2 weeks ago, I mentioned that at the end, by the end of chapter 14, everybody's spoken at least once, but except for as we get into the book, there's another character added, but we'll get there. But all of Job's three friends have spoken once so far, and then things kind of repeat themselves. A lot of the same arguments are made, and made maybe in a more aggressive way as we continue. So Eliphaz begins speaking again here in chapter 15. And right away, we can make a connection between his speeches. So in verse 1, it says, "Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, 'Should a wise man answer with empty knowledge and fill himself with the east wind?'" He says in verse 3, "Should he reason with unprofitable talk or by speeches with which he can do no good? Yes, you cast off fear and restrain prayer before God, for your iniquity teaches your mouth, and you choose the tongue of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you and not I. Yes, your own lips testify against you." So if you remember back in chapter 4, back in chapter 4 when Eliphaz begins talking to Job, after Job breaks that initial silence, right, with his complaint, Eliphaz is the first one to chime in, and he says in verse 2, "If one attempts a word with you, will you become weary? But who can withhold himself from speaking? Surely you have instructed many, and you have strengthened weak hands. Your words have upheld him who is stumbling, and you have strengthened the feeble knees." So he starts out acknowledging that Job is a respectable, wise individual. And then by chapter 15, he kind of sounds disgusted with the way that Job is talking. It's like if, you know, an influential person in your life falls away and starts to speak with coarse language and starts to say things that just aren't worth saying. And they, you know, they become vulgar. And that's kind of what Eliphaz thinks is happening. And you can imagine how you would feel if that were the case. But Job's words are not empty. It's not empty knowledge. And the east wind there, that's a reference to the desert wind that would have been scorching and destructive. And you know, it's just Eliphaz's way of saying that your words don't have anything good in them. Then he says in verse 3, it's unprofitable talk, speeches with which he can do no good. And then he brings in that accusation of sin there in verse 5, "Your iniquity teaches your mouth, and you choose the tongue of the crafty." So he thinks Job is guilty, and so he is thinking of Job as being prideful and crafty in trying to defend himself and his integrity. In verse 7, he says, "Are you the first man who was born, or were you made before the hills? Have you heard the counsel of God? Do you limit wisdom to yourself? What do you know that we do not know? What do you understand that is not in us?" So one of the things that Eliphaz does here is there's pretty obvious sarcasm almost. And it seems like it's an attempt to discredit what Job has done, or what Job has just said previously. So Job has gone through, if you remember, and starting in chapter 12, he gives a three-chapter speech. And in that speech, he essentially ridicules his friends for being for not being wise and for being mockers instead of comforters. And he starts talking about that again shortly. But he talks about his understanding of God. And in chapter 13, he's saying things like, "Behold, my eye has seen all of this. My ear has understood it. What you know, I also know. I'm not inferior to you." And so you can kind of see how Eliphaz would have been trying to discredit those statements and discredit Job's wisdom by saying, "Are you the first man who was born? Do you think that you know more than we do?" Says in verse 8, "Have you heard the counsel of God? Do you limit wisdom to yourself?" Now, Job didn't limit wisdom to himself. I think that's important to acknowledge. He didn't pridefully say or arrogantly say, "Well, I know more than you." He said, "I'm not inferior to you." Those are two completely different motives, two completely different ideas there. So you can kind of see Job's humility and also see the way that Eliphaz perceived what Job said as being arrogant and prideful because he has assumed his guilt. And there's those two references that Job only asked for quality in the conversation, not superiority. Verse 10, both the gray-haired and the aged are among us, much older than your father. Are the consolations of God too small for you, and the words spoken gently with you? Why does your heart carry you away, and what do your eyes wink at, that you turn your spirit against God and let such words go out of your mouth? So, by saying, or in saying, are the consolations of God too small for you, and the words spoken gently with you? Eliphaz is talking about the advice that he, Bildad, and Zophar have been giving Job this whole time. He's essentially saying that's the wisdom that God would have him be given in this moment. That what they're saying is the consolations of God. And the words spoken gently would be him talking about the same thing, that it's the advice given by those three friends. I don't think that's a really accurate description of their advice. And I don't think that God thinks that either, but there's evidence there that they are kind of trying to put themselves in between God and Job to speak on God's behalf, essentially. In verse 14, Eliphaz says, "What is man that he could be pure, and he who is born of a woman that he could be righteous? If God puts no trust in his saints, and the heavens are not pure in his sight, how much less man who is abominable and filthy, who drinks iniquity like water?" Okay, here's my question for you. What pretty common false doctrine does Eliphaz sound like right now? Where man is just abominable, filthy, cannot possibly be righteous.
Calvinism,
yeah. I made the joke when we started studying Job to Nathan that Job's friends were the first Calvinists, but it kind of sounds like it here. In other places, they start kind of sounding like the health and wealth gospel. And you could probably go through the book. We won't for time's sake, but you could probably go through the book and look at the friends' speeches and probably make a lot of comparisons to false doctrine. Because they have ideas that are deceptive about God's nature. And some people subscribe to those ideas as well. But in verse 14 here, the word righteous that Eliphaz is using is the Hebrew word tzadok. And I'm pretty sure tonight we'll get to another place where Job uses the word righteousness, and it's a different Hebrew word. And it means something different. And we'll get to that. But it's the same thing as what Job talked about in chapter 9, in verse 2, where he himself acknowledges, he says, "Truly, I know it is so, but how can a man be righteous before God? If one wished to contend with him, he could not answer him one time out of a thousand." It's this idea, tzadok, is about being righteous of your own volition, of your own deciding. It's justifying yourself, deciding that you are right. And Eliphaz is saying that man can't do that. Now, in some context, that's right. We cannot decide what's right. We have to align ourselves with God in order to be righteous. but I think Eliphaz takes it too far here. And certainly, it's misapplied in Job's case. In verse 17, Eliphaz goes back to some of his old tricks and also takes some stuff from Bildad's speech. He says in verse 17, "I will tell you, hear me. What I have seen, I will declare." So he starts making his argument again based on his own personal experience. You can look at chapter 4 and verse 8, where he says, "Even as I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the blast of God they perish, and by the breath of his anger they are consumed." So Eliphaz likes to think about things and teach people things just based on his own experiences, not in place of where the wisdom of God should be. In verse 18, he says, "What wise men have told, not hiding anything received from their fathers, to whom alone the land was given, and no alien passed among them." He starts talking about the wisdom of the ancients, right? So he says, "Well, my personal experience and the wisdom of these old people, agrees." And those are the things that are going to condemn you, Job, is what he says there. And in chapter 8, you can see Bildad do kind of the same thing. Chapter 8, verses 8 and 9, where he says, "For inquire, please, of the former age, and consider the things discovered by their fathers. For we were born yesterday and know nothing, because our days on earth are a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you in utter words from their heart?" So, again, you can learn things from your own personal experiences. I'm still on the younger side of life, so I don't have a whole lot of personal experiences compared to a lot of you here. But there's value in that. There's value in experience. Don't get me wrong on that. There's also a lot of value in the wisdom of the ancient people. There's a lot of value in the wisdom of people older than yourself, and who have had more experiences. And that's what Eliphaz is saying here. But we can never allow those things to take the place of God's wisdom. And I think that that's what has happened in Eliphaz's mind. He's approaching it from solely those sources instead of God's wisdom supplemented by those sources, as it should be.
With science and economics, you have the saying that correlation does not always equal causation.
Yeah.
So it seems like they're going about it the wrong way, that if it's dressed up exactly like what we've heard of before, then obviously it must be this way. So they're really looking at the end result of Job and saying, well, because he's in this state, that this is exactly what's wrong. And therefore standing firm on that and feeling like they're right about it. And then that makes them, get almost offended and get riled up like he was here, and say, like, and telling Job that, even though he's saying I'm equal with you, they hear you're saying I'm wrong. The negative with it, and I'll feel defensive. And I think that's one lesson that we can learn. One is that we can't just, take it at face value, that just because it looks like somebody else doesn't mean that it's the same. So the correlation, there may be, but we really need to dig deeper sometimes when we're looking at problems or causes. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, really listen and pay attention whenever especially in a situation like this, rather than just jump to conclusions and get defensive.
Yeah. And Job has defended himself to his friends for multiple times, right? And then they continue to use the same devices to try and prove their point. It proves they're not listening and not paying attention to what he's saying. Yeah, I actually like that correlation and causation thing. I'm going to draw it real quick because there's your graph in economics or society, people use it like this. If the lines match, like that's the sinful people who suffer, right? And then Job is here, and his friends go, well, obviously he's sinful because he matches all the sinful people's experience. But, just because his experience is the same doesn't mean that it's caused by the same thing. And that's what Job's question is why am I having the same experience when it cannot possibly be the same cause?
Right.
And so, and the friends just aren't acknowledging.
They're not acknowledging the data points, if you think about that. He's trying to resist, I haven't done this thing. Mm-hmm. You even acknowledge that way you've witnessed the way I live. So in a way, they're actually not even taking their own eyewitnessing into account of his character.
Yeah.
And just assuming that therefore he must be sinful because he's in this.
Exactly. Yeah. And eventually, one of the things that Job asks God for is, and complains to God about, is he says, I need you to come talk to me about this because my friends don't have any wisdom. You've withheld wisdom from them. I need to talk to you. And that's part of his plea as we get further into the book. But yeah, they certainly aren't acknowledging or listening to any of the facts about the situation. They're just assumptive. Yeah. In verse 20, Eliphaz starts talking about the wicked man. And throughout the next three speeches by Job's friends, with Eliphaz followed by Bildad and then followed by Zophar, you'll catch little phrases that they say that really point to the fact that they're talking about Job. They're just not saying his name. They're saying the wicked man experiences this, but they really mean Job experiences this. And you'll probably hear those as we go based on what we've read already. But in verse 20, he says, "The wicked man writhes with pain all his days." It's talking about Job because he's got boils all over his skin, right? "And the number of years is hidden from the oppressor. Dreadful sounds are in his ears. In prosperity, the destroyer comes upon him." That also points to Job. He was prosperous and rich and wealthy and well-to-do, and then the destroyer came upon him. "He does not believe that he will return from darkness, for a sword is waiting for him. He wanders about for bread, saying, 'Where is it?' He knows that a day of darkness is ready at his hand." That points to a lot of the things that Job has complained about, life being hopeless and darkness waiting for him, waiting to go to Sheol, right? Things like that. Verse 24, "Trouble and anguish make him afraid. They overpower him like a king ready for battle. For he stretches out his hand against God and acts defiantly against the Almighty, running stubbornly against him with a strong embossed shield." So there's Eliphaz essentially doing the correlation causation thing. Like, this is the experience of the wicked man. Here's why he experiences that. And that applies to you, Job, but it doesn't. In verse 27, it says, "Though he has covered his face with his fatness and made his waist heavy with fat, he dwells in desolate cities and houses which no one inhabits, which are destined to become ruins. He will not be rich, nor will his wealth continue, nor will his possessions overspread the earth. He will not depart from darkness. The flame will dry out his branches, and by the breath of his mouth he will go away. Let him not trust in futile things, deceiving himself, for futility will be his reward." We'll come back to that statement. And then verse 32, "It will be accomplished before his time, and his branch will not be green. He will shake off his unripe grape like a vine, and cast off his blossom like an olive tree. For the company of hypocrites will be barren, and fire will consume the tents of bribery. They conceive trouble and bring forth futility. Their womb prepares deceit." So in a lot of very strong language, he's essentially describing Job's circumstance and attributing it to the fact that he is a wicked man. Or that Eliphaz thinks he is a wicked man. But what he says in verse 31, "Let him not trust in futile things, deceiving himself, for futility will be his reward." That is an important misunderstanding that Eliphaz has. And I think it speaks to something that Christians can go through when they suffer and hold on to their faith. But back in chapter 13, when Job is kind of in one of his high points, right? He's demonstrating his resolve to hold on to his faith. He says in chapter 13 and verse 15, "Though he slay me, yet I will trust him." Talking about God. So Job's trust, right, is in the right place. And he's trusting in God even in the face of suffering. And he's determined to do that. And then Eliphaz comes along and says, "Let him not trust in futile things, deceiving himself." And I think that's one of the more applicable things that people do to Christians who are trying to hold on to their faith. You go through an awful thing of suffering, and you maintain that faith in God, and you demonstrate that faith in God. You will probably hear people say something like, "Why do you keep praying to God? You're still going through all of this stuff. Why trust in somebody who's not doing anything for you?" And that sentiment, maybe it's not exactly those words, but that idea gets put into people's minds by the outside world, by Satan. And it's also similar to Job's wife, right? Why do you still hold to your integrity? Curse God and die. But Job is determined to hold to his integrity. And when we suffer, there's a good chance that we'll meet that opposition. Why would you continue to hold on to somebody? Why would you trust in somebody who's obviously not fixing your situation? Or Why would you trust somebody who allowed you to get into this situation in the first place? So be ready for that. But trusting in God is never futile. Do we have any comments or questions through chapter 15? Then we will go ahead and get into chapter 16, where Job answers. He says in verse 1, "Then Job answered and said, 'I've heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all.'" There's sometimes there's just very sometimes it's extremely poetic with a lot of analogies and all kinds of things. Sometimes this dialogue is very direct. And here's a point where Job is direct. "I've heard many such things." So he's, you know, stop repeating yourselves. Stop, you know, stop telling me the same thing over and over again. Stop bringing up the same stuff. "You're miserable comforters." He's right. They are. They're miserable comforters. And, you know, it's part of what we're learning is how to not be like Job's friends when we are trying to be there for people who are suffering. But he says in verse 3, "Shall words of wind have an end?" So he's, you know, he uses that same words of wind analogy that Eliphaz just used about his words. Should a wise man answer with empty knowledge and fill himself with the east wind? He said, well, your words are that way. Shall words of wind have an end? Or what provokes you that you answer? In verse 4, he says, "I also could speak as you do. If your soul were in my soul's place, I could heap up words against you and shake my head at you. But I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the comfort of my lips would relieve your grief." So Job essentially, you know, there's kind of a plea there. Put yourself in my shoes for a minute, and I'll put myself in your shoes. Here's how I would go about it. And here's what should be done in a situation like this for the sufferer. And, you know, he's asking for sympathy there. And it's evidently something that's lacking, because he calls them miserable comforters. And then he pleads for their sympathy in that way. In verse 6, he says, "Though I speak, my grief is not relieved. And if I remain silent, how am I eased?" That's a really beautiful way of saying, you know, if I say nothing and just hold it all in, it's going to eat me alive. But whenever I say something, everybody ridicules me for it. And there's mockery from my friends. I'm sure everybody can probably think of a time where they felt that way. But it's not fun. And that's what Job's situation is here. It says in verse 7, "But now he has worn me out." Then he starts talking about God. And he uses strong language. So, sorry, I got drainage. He uses strong language and kind of sounds like he's blaming God for some stuff. So in verse 7 he says, "But now he has worn me out. You have made me desolate, all my company. You have shriveled me up, and it is a witness against me. My leanness rises up against me and bears witness to my face." Still talking about God. "He tears me in his wrath." That comes back here in a little bit. "And hates me. He gnashes at me with his teeth. My adversary sharpens his gaze on me. They gape at me with their mouth." So this is about his friends. "They gape at me with their mouth. They strike me reproachfully on the cheek. They gather together against me." And then he gives credit to all of those experiences from his friends to God. He says, "God has delivered me to the ungodly and turned me over to the hands of the wicked. I was at ease, but he shattered me. He also has taken me by my neck and shaken me to pieces. He has set me up for his target. His archers surround me and pierce my heart. He pierces my heart and does not pity. He pours out my gall on the ground. He breaks me with wound upon wound. He runs at me like a warrior." So that's a lot. You know, you could go through each one of those things and talk about how awful the experience would be. And for time's sake, we won't. But Job feels like the Almighty Creator has picked him up by his neck and shaken him. That's pretty strong. That's a powerful, awful thing that he has in his heart. But then in verse 15, there's the dilemma. So he feels like God is against him, Then in verse 15, he says, I have sown sackcloth over my skin and laid my head in the dust. My face is flushed from weeping, and on my eyelids is the shadow of death. Although no violence is in my hands, and my prayer is pure. What did the people of Nineveh do when Jonah went through and preached that they were going to be destroyed in 40 days, right? Do you remember?
Covered themselves with sackcloth.
Yeah. They sat in ashes, sackcloth, they fasted. Job is penitent. His behavior is the traditional way to show repentance. And so he's essentially saying, like, I didn't do anything wrong, but I'm going to repent anyway because God is against me for some reason, and I can't figure out why, and I can't figure out what I did to deserve that. So that's the cognitive dissonance going through his mind. He says in verse 18, O earth, do not cover my blood, and let my cry have no resting place. Surely even now my witness is in heaven, and my evidence is on high. My friends scorn me. My eyes pour out tears to God. Oh, that one might plead for a man with God, as a man pleads for his neighbor. For when a few years are finished, I shall go the way of no return. So there's a piece of Job's resolve again, but also his challenge. You know, he says, I'm innocent. I'm penitent even though I'm innocent, and my evidence is in heaven. I will be vindicated in this, is his decision in his mind here. And then in chapter 17, in verse 1, Job continues. He says, my spirit is broken, my days are extinguished, the grave is ready for me, are not mockers with me, and does not my eye dwell on their provocation? So that's again going back to the miserable comforters are you all, and also, you know, in the last chapter, verse 20, my friends scorn me, my eyes pour out tears to God. So he's mocked by those around him. The grave is ready for him. He feels as though he's about to die. And then in verse 3, in the midst of that experience, he says, now put down a pledge for me with yourself. So he's speaking to God. Put down a pledge for me with yourself. Who is he who will shake hands with me? For you have hidden their hearts from understanding. Therefore, you will not exalt them. He who speaks flattery to his friends, even the eyes of his children, will fail. So there's Job essentially saying, I need God to step in here and reason with me on this, because my friends, he's hidden understanding from them. They're not helpful in the situation. They don't have the wisdom necessary. In verse 6, it says, but he has made me a byword of the people. And, naturally there's the connection to chapter 1 where it calls Job the greatest of all the people of the East, right? But then he's taken down so many notches that he goes to the bottom of the totem pole. So you can imagine how people would use him to describe that suffering. And what's interesting is Job is still a byword of the people. You know, how many times you hear people, anytime suffering is brought up, well, it's like Job. Well, you know, he is synonymous with having it great and losing everything. And he feels that even here in the midst of the situation. He's made me a byword of the people, and I've become one in whose face men spit. It says in verse 7, my eye has also grown dim because of sorrow, and all my members are like shadows. Then he says, upright men are astonished at this, and the innocent stirs himself up against the hypocrite. Yet the righteous will hold to his way, and he who has clean hands will be stronger and stronger. I like to think that Job is describing himself in verse 9, that it's another one of those points where he shows his resolve to hold on to God even in the midst of all of this, where he says, yet the righteous will hold to his way, and he who has clean hands will be stronger and stronger. In verse 8, though, he says, upright men are astonished at this, saying that people who have wisdom, people who have understanding, who are upright, and are approaching it with a good heart, are astonished at his situation because it doesn't make sense. That's in contrast to his friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, who think they can just explain it by saying, well, you're sinful. That's obviously the reason. So he's drawing that contrast between them and the upright who would have a hard time understanding Job's situation because it's difficult. And then the word righteous that he uses here is tzaddik. And this word is different from tzaddak, which is talking about self-justification, self-righteousness, and deciding that you're right. Tzaddik is talking about someone who is right because they are aligned with God. So there's that connotation there where Eliphaz says, what is a man that he can be righteous, right? That's tzaddik. How can a man justify himself? Chapter 9, verse 2, that's tzaddik. But here in chapter 17 and verse 9, it's the righteous, those who are aligned with God and are therefore right, will hold to his way, and he who has clean hands will be stronger and stronger. And then in verse 10, he says, but please come back again, all of you. It's kind of a challenge to his friends. You could also word it as, hit me again. Come on, bring your arguments. I'm ready for him, is his way of saying it. But come back again, all of you, for I shall not find one wise man among you. My days are past, my purposes are broken off. Even the thoughts of my heart, they change the night into day. The light is near, they say, in the face of darkness. If I wait for the grave as my house, if I make my bed in the darkness, if I say to corruption, you are my father, and to the worm, you are my mother and my sister, where then is my hope? As for my hope, who can see it? Will they go down to the gates of Sheol? Shall we have rest together in the dust? So, Job demonstrates kind of his ability to hold two things in his mind. And I think that he does that throughout the book. But he holds his extreme despair and also his faith in God and his integrity at the same time. And that's a difficult thing to do, and I think it's commendable. And I think it's important for us to practice that, because it's easy when our emotions run high to forget about our righteousness, our integrity, and forget about God and start to focus on, you know, we go inside ourselves and start to think about only what we need, what we want to fix our situation. But Job holds on to both at the same time. And his hopelessness, you know, there's that pattern. Verse 8, upright men are astonished at this, yet the righteous will hold to his way. So there's hope there in his speech. And then, please come back again, all of you, for I shall not find one wise man among you. There's the variable, right, that changes it. So he's got some hope, focused on his being righteous, holding on to his faith. But his friends, who are not being helpful, but are actually being destructive in speaking to him and speaking about him, cause him to go back into that hopelessness. You can see it right there in the text. He's got the hope, I shall not find one wise man among you. And then immediately, my days are past, my purposes are broken off, even the thoughts of my heart, they change the night into day. And the light is near, they say, in the face of darkness. So their speech is useless, he's saying there. And where then is my hope? Follows after that. As for my hope, who can see it? So you can see the effect that their lack of comfort, their accusations have on him as he speaks there. Do we have any comments or questions through chapters 16 and 17? If not, then that is what I have for you for this evening. Next week, we will get into Bildad's second speech. And he starts off with, how long till you put an end to words? So I deemed him impatient Bildad. So you can steal that and remember it that way. But we'll get into Bildad's speech next week. There's now an invitation if anyone needs prayers or if you need our help with conquering something that's in your life, then this is a time for you, if you feel the need to come forward, please do so as we stand and sing.